Our health is so important to us, we talk about it a lot. I mean, think about it. We run the gamut from angry claims about death panels to a full suite of medical jokes. You know, doctor, it hurts when I do this. The doctor says, then don't do that. Humor aside, that interaction between doctor and patient is critical for treatment, and critical to treatment is context, the doctor understanding some things beyond the patient's symptoms. This hour's guests studied that issue extensively and published a book called Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. They're written by Saul Wiener, MD, and Ellen Schwartz, a PhD psychologist. Saul Wiener is board certified in internal medicine and pediatrics. He's worked in a number of places on improving health systems. He's now the vice provost for planning and programs and professor of medicine, pediatrics, and medical education at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Welcome, Dr. Wiener.
Thank you.
Alan Schwartz is the cognitive psychologist, also aiming largely at improving health systems. He's now the Michael Reese Endowed Professor of Medical Education and Associate Head of the Department of Medical Education and Research Professor in the Department of Pediatrics, also at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Dr. Schwartz, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
So you two have been at this for a while. You share a blog at contextualizingcare.org. What does that mean, contextualizing care? Dr. Wiener?
Well, I think you're right. It does go way back for the two of us. We've been working on this, and part of that process has been defining what we mean when we talk about contextualizing care. There are lots of stories I'd like to share, but just to answer your question, context is everything that's going on in a person's life that's relevant to something. In this case, it's to their health care. So it's useful to think about what's not context. Context is the stuff going on inside your body. So when you go to the physician, the physician checks your lab tests, your potassium. They do an EKG. They perhaps do a CT scan, depending on what you... That's under the skin stuff. But whether you can pay for your care, whether you have the social support you need to manage your care, whether you have the transportation to get to those appointments or have your Coumadin level checked, that's the context. And so the context is everything going on in your life that's relevant to your care.
So I couldn't ask for a more straightforward book. Part one is the problem. Part two is the solution. So the problem basically is just that medical professionals are not including enough other details besides the patient's condition?
Yeah, you know, I think the interesting thing is that medical professionals probably interact with patients in a way that's a little different from the way they hopefully talk to their family members and their friends. I think that when we're interacting with people who are our friends, who we know well, we do think contextually. We think about the big picture. If your friend has started to act differently and they're not showing up when they said they would come by, or they seem like they're in a bad mood when they used to be in a good mood, you would probably ask them, you know, what's going on? What's happened? What's changed? But what we found in our research, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, is that physicians somehow seem to have these blinders on, not all of them, but many of them and much of the time, where in interacting with patients, they're sort of have a laser-like focus on the biomedical stuff, which is important. But as we've shown that in many of our projects and studies, that kind of narrow focus often results in a care plan that looks great on paper but is unlikely to be successful.
So, Alan Schwartz, the book acknowledges two general trends, evidence-based medicine and humanistic medicine. What are the differences between them?
So, evidence-based medicine really has come of age in the last 30 years, and it's about teaching doctors how to read the clinical research literature and understand what the evidence from research trials says about how you should treat patients who are typical of a kind of condition. And at the same time, medical schools have begun to focus increasingly on this humanistic aspect of medicine. How should doctors interact with patients in a way that is kind of friendly and affirming and not patronizing or condescending? The book, though, it sort of charts a place between those two. It's not about the evidence that applies to all patients. It's about what's specific about this patient's life context that might make them different from the average patient. And it's not just about how to be a nice doctor. It's about a set of skills in terms of finding out what that life context is and how it affects a patient's health and what to do about it.
It's almost a hand slap upside your own head. I mean, in the sense of, you know, everything has to be done on a case-by-case basis. And that's particularly true in medicine, where each person's circumstances are somewhat different.
Yeah,
absolutely.
You know, I think what Alan was getting at is that there's been, you know, medicine tends to sort of have these bandwagons, these trends. Everybody jumps on board something for a while. And over the last 20 or 30 years, the bandwagon has been evidence-based medicine, this idea that we need to know the science, we need to know the best practices. And that is absolutely true. When you go to your doctor, you want to be sure that that doctor knows what the studies have shown. If you have a particular condition, what are, in fact, the best practices based on the best scientific evidence. So that's evidence. That's a key part of evidence-based medicine. But you also want to make sure that when you walk out of that office visit, that the care plan is actually going to work for you. And the research evidence is just not enough to come up with that care plan. The truth is, when you look at research evidence, you're looking at data that has been pooled from hundreds or thousands of patients, and so it has no context. It's just sort of assuming a kind of invisible patient or an imaginary patient that doesn't really exist. Real people have lives. They have complex problems. Often they don't understand their care, or perhaps they're supposed to give themselves a shot, but they have arthritic hands and they're not able to do that, or perhaps the medicine they've put on is something they can't afford. And so simply following best practices and guidelines isn't going to send patients out the door with a care plan that's actually going to work for them. And so the focus of our interest has been really on taking research evidence and all of the emphasis on that, and then combining it with a set of cognitive skills that doctors and other healthcare providers need to make sure that when that patient walks out the door, that care plan is actually going to work for them. And we've done a lot of research showing that, unfortunately, so much of the time, that just isn't the case.
All right, and we'll hear about the whole process that led up to this. It's very fascinating. It involved actually using actors posing as patients, and you'll hear about all that when we come back and talk more with Saul Wiener, MD, and Alan Schwartz, PhD psychologist. Their book is Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. We'll come back to the exchange with our two doctors and you in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about getting treatment, medical treatment, from people who may not be listening to you with a full set of ears because they're listening for the medical conditions and not so much for some of the life context issues that can interfere with treatments. The book written by Saul Wiener and Alan Schwartz is called Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. Saul is an MD. Alan is a PhD psychologist. You can join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about the specific approach that led to the book, Alan, and how you obtained the information for it.
Yeah, so one of the things that we realized is that these kinds of issues, these contextual issues that are individual to each of us, are going to be very hard to study by looking at, say, medical records. Medical records show you what the doctor was thinking, but they don't really show you what's unique about the patient. If the doctor doesn't ask about it, it never makes it into the record. So we began by sending actors. We call them unannounced standardized patients. They're trained to portray patients, and we send them in to doctors to pretending to be patients, visiting the doctor. And our standardized patients are trained to come in and present different cues that might suggest there's something about their life that needs to be addressed in the visit. And then we can listen to the audio recording they make of the visit and compare that with the chart and find out what the doctor actually did about it.
All right, so it's an interesting term, USPs. I noticed it gets used a fair amount in the book, unannounced standardized or standardized patients. How tricky was it to settle this up and not make medical professionals suspicious?
Wow. Well, we call that the subterfuge. And it's very tricky, actually. It requires a fair amount of planning. First of all, of course, the doctors consent. They understand that they're going to have some patients who are fake and they won't know who they are. It's also important that they feel safe doing this, and we guarantee them that we won't use their names and we'll remove their names from any data that we analyze. And then we have to make sure that it looks like a real visit when it happens. So typically there's somebody in the practice administration who's helping us, who knows who the fake patients are, and we have quite an elaborate ruse that we set up so that when they appear, they seem to be registered with insurance, and the front desk has no reason to think they're not a real patient. So, and we're not the only folks who've done this. Other researchers have done this quite well, and we certainly talked to them before we got going on this. But yes, it's a bit of an artifice. It's quite tricky to get this just right, and we actually found that very few of our physicians detect the unannounced standardized patients we send them.
There were moments that it seemed like mission impossible in here where the doctor would say, well, you know, I need to run this test. And the patient would say, well, geez, I can't take my clothes off because then they'll see the recorder. So they had to come up with some, they had to be prepared to deal with some things that went a little off the script they were given.
Absolutely. And, you know, most of the people we worked with were professional actors, although that's by no means required. And all of them had prior experience being what are called standardized patients as opposed to unannounced standardized patients. Just to clarify the difference, almost all medical schools now use standardized patients to train medical students and residents. And these are just people from the community who come in and role play particular medical conditions. But at the time, the medical student or resident knows that they are, in fact, interacting with an actor. It's done in a laboratory-type setting, and so it's very clear that this is not a real patient. We take these individuals and we retrain them to go undercover into real practice settings, which is quite different for them because they sort of say it feels like a con. They're going in there and, you know, the folks who they're interacting with don't realize that they are, in fact, acting. And that's a very different psychological situation, and we obviously had to prepare them for that and practice quite a bit. And also, of course, as you noted, things can happen in the real care setting that they have to be able to deal with, so that it doesn't get very awkward or that they don't end up, you know, having to reveal that they're, in fact, one of the unannounced standardized patients.
Saul Wiener and Alan Schwartz are guests on the Jefferson Exchange. Their book, Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. So let's talk about some of those errors. And one of the first examples in the book is one that kind of sets the tone for the rest, in that it was about a woman who needed dialysis, but it was really not a matter of what the procedure was, but where she was getting it that led to the issues with her treatment.
Yeah, this this was in fact a real patient, and in fact even our fake patients are based entirely on real patients. But this woman was sort of typical of what, unfortunately, emergency medicine type doctors often refer to as frequent flyers. These are people who just keep to come back over and over again to the emergency room, often with the same problem. And there's a tendency to just think that they don't have a good attitude, or that you know, they just don't have their act together. And in this case, it was a woman who kept coming back because she'd missed her dialysis. And each time she would get dialyzed, and she'd be sent home the next day with stern instructions not to miss her dialysis again. Part of the problem was that her English wasn't very good. She was Spanish-speaking. But we see this even with people who speak English well. And as you kind of alluded to, we discovered when we actually, with a medical student, asked her a little bit more about what the reasons were for why she kept coming back, and a story came out, not surprisingly, that this woman had responsibility for a sick child. It was actually a young boy who was, a grandson, and basically she had to make a decision on a fairly regular basis about whether to get care for herself or to bring him in for care, because he actually had his own chronic conditions and needed frequent care. And so, being a responsible parent type, she opted to put her child's care before her own and would often miss her dialysis because she was taking her child somewhere. Once we discovered this, we actually arranged for her to get her dialysis at the same site where her child was getting care. And lo and behold, she never showed up in the ER again, made it to all her dialysis appointments.
But how much does it figure that medical pros just kind of get ticked off with the so-called non-compliant patients, the people they think aren't following their instructions well enough?
Well, you know, Alan can comment on an interesting phenomenon that he taught me about called the fundamental attribution error. Alan, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, it's one of these things that that is taught in social psychology, and it's called fundamental because it's observed in so many places. And it's the idea that when I do something, I assume it's because of the environment that I'm in and I'm sort of forced to do it. But when you do something, I assume that it's something about your personality. So if I don't take my medication every day, it's because I was too busy that morning and I had to run out, and you know, I'll make up for it. But if you don't take your medication every day, then there's something about you. You're really not paying attention. And that operates for everybody, and it operates for doctors.
And it's, you know, basically just a way of saying that we all tend to be judgmental. But if you're a doctor, being judgmental can really undermine the care of your patients, because once you pass a judgment on somebody, you stop being curious. If you think that the person keeps not coming to the ER because they don't care about their illness or they're not responsible, then because you think you know why, you're probably not going to ask them. But if you just keep an open mind and say, you know, I have no idea why this person keeps coming back, I think I'm going to find out, then a story comes out, and oftentimes it's something you can do something about. And what's remarkable is, think about the cost of this woman coming back to the ER repeatedly, having to be admitted and getting dialysis, simply because no one had identified and helped her solve a simple logistical problem.
Even before then, you get to the issues of noncompliance, though. I mean, you must hear from doctors, and certainly doctors in training where you are, that it takes a long time to get to know a patient.
You know, what's interesting is that we found in our study where we used unannounced standardized patients that the physicians who did a good job of picking up on context did not, on average, spend any more time with their patients than the ones who kind of missed the boat. And so, for instance, we had an actor who went to about 50 doctors, and she always said the same thing. She came in with, this was a male patient, came in with a complaint of worsening asthma, and always dropped the comment, "Boy, it's been tough since I've lost my job." And we'd written this script to see if the physician would pick up on that clue and ask about it. If they did, the actor would reveal that they were basically on a very expensive brand-name drug that they couldn't afford, and that their asthma was getting worse because they really weren't taking it every day, and that would prompt the physician to switch them to a simple, cheaper generic drug that basically has the same ingredients but costs a lot less and would actually address their underlying problem, which is they couldn't afford the medicine. We found that in less than half the time did the physician pick up on that clue and say, "Boy, it's been tough since I've lost," you know, respond to that prompt and say, "Well, what's going on? You know, what's happened with you're losing your job, or you having trouble paying for your medicine?" A minority of physicians would pick up on that clue, and then when they did, a good number of them would switch the patient to this cheaper generic and send the patient out. The others would often say things like, "You know, I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have any allergies?" In other words, just kind of brush right by it. And what was fascinating to us is that, on average, the length of the visit between these two situations, exactly the same patient, same actor doing the same thing, was on average the same. So while, yes, it's always valuable to have more time to get to know your patient, even within a fixed time constraint, some doctors have a wider angle lens than others and pick up on these contextual clues, and others don't seem to notice them.
Did you probe as deep as to ask the doctor why they didn't follow up on that particular flag?
Well, that's a great question. When we set up this study, we asked physicians if they wanted to know how they did. About a third of them said they'd like feedback. Now, we told them that the way we designed the study, we didn't really have enough data from any single physician to draw general conclusions about how a physician performs compared to peers. It was more that we pooled the data. So the focus of the study was to collect this data and report on what we learned in aggregate about large numbers of physicians. What we didn't do was design the study so that we could essentially then go back and kind of debrief the physicians and find out why they pursued these questions and why some of them didn't. Now, subsequently, and anecdotally, we've had many conversations with physicians about why they may or may not ask these questions, and I can certainly share with you some of the things that they tell us. So, for instance, physicians sometimes feel like asking questions outside of the biomedical realm is intrusive. Sometimes they feel like they're rushed and they don't have time. Those are the kinds of things that we hear. But what's interesting is none of those explanations really help us differentiate between those physicians who do, in fact, ask those probing questions from those who don't.
Saul Wiener is a medical doctor. Alan Schwartz is a cognitive psychologist. They are both teachers as well, and they've cooperated on a book called Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the things that doctors miss that really don't involve the biomedical stuff just so much as the life details. Join us at 800-838-3760 by phone. Maybe you have some stories about things that doctors might have caught in talking to you and didn't. You can also join us by email at jx@jeffnet.org. How hard can it be, though? I mean, doctors aside, I mean, how hard can it be for some patients to illuminate details of their own lives? I mean, things they might not even want to talk about. Not everybody wants to say, "Hey, you know, I lost my job."
Alan, thoughts on that one?
Well, that's right. So there are some things where there are some cases where a patient might know what's going on in their life, but be as you say, embarrassed or reticent to talk about it. And there's only so much that you can do with that. You know, we would encourage people, if they know what's going on, what's getting in the way of their health, to try to bring it up to their physician, and we would encourage them to find a physician who's non-judgmental so that they don't feel embarrassed. But there are also plenty of things where we know that there's something going on in our life, but we don't recognize that that's what's causing the health problem. So in the case that Saul just described, the guy with the asthma medication in the case didn't realize that this was an asthma medication that had to be taken every day to be effective. And by stretching it out, he was in fact making it ineffective. So he knew that he had lost his job. He knew that he had to stretch out this medication. He didn't make the connection to the health outcome. And that's hard for patients to do. That's why we have doctors, is because they know those kinds of things.
I think also he wasn't aware there was a cheaper alternative.
Really? Okay, that would help too. Some of these stories are almost, you know, they almost make you cry. I mean, like the man who had major dental issues but didn't want a dentist, and somebody asked him enough questions to finally get him to reveal what the issue was.
Yeah, in that particular case, this was an African American gentleman who had really experienced abuse from the healthcare system many years prior, at a time where injections were often given in a way that was unsanitary and brutal, and he had developed a tremendous phobia of needles, and so he had spent his lifetime avoiding getting dental care and really was very embarrassed to acknowledge it. He was a veteran, regarded himself as really a tough man, and he was there at the appointment with his wife, and you know, it really only came out when we really probed about why he was demanding antibiotics when we were telling him that that was not going to do the trick. And I think, you know, what we've learned is that sometimes the best way to show you care is to ask questions. You know, there's been a great deal of emphasis on the importance of empathy in healthcare, which is this idea that you should sort of feel the pain of your patient. But I think we take a different perspective. Alan and I take a much more cognitive perspective, and we think that, you know, if you're going to the physician, it's less important that that physician can sort of feel your pain or be empathic, and more important that they are very caring in a concrete way that involves trying to figure out what specifically is going on in your life that they need to know so that the care plan is right for you. And sometimes that involves asking difficult, you know, questions. If the patient is saying something that doesn't add up, you know, like you're telling them that they need to see a dentist and they keep saying, no, just give me antibiotics, rather than just arguing with them, ask them why. You know, what tell me what's going on. Like, why I'm telling you something I don't understand. There's a disconnect. It's in many ways it's a level of respect. You're not writing off the patient as some sort of lunatic or kind of poorly educated person. You're taking them at face value and saying, you know, I just don't understand where you're coming from. Can you help me? It's really a form of respect and caring. And we found that when physicians do that, and some of them do, often what comes out is very important information that ultimately results in a care plan that's going to make sense and more likely to be effective.
Let's take a call. Here's Jacob in Springfield. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Saul Wiener and Alan Schwartz, the authors of Listening for What Matters. Hi, Jacob.
Hi. Every time you meet a patient for the first time, it's a get-to-know-you kind of thing. And the one question you always have to ask, and maybe reevaluation, is this patient a reliable narrator? Is this patient sane? You literally have to question every day, you know, if the next time you meet them is, are they sane? And a lot of the times it's just small talk. Some, you know, we say, how are you? How are you doing? And people answer. We expect these answers. But this is actually kind of a key test to seeing if somebody's sane. If they can't maintain simple small talk, they can't maintain the big talk, you know, and they might be have issues of antisocialness or, you know, like, you know, personality disorders. But I would want to stress that there's a lot of mental illness and personality disorders and addiction problems in our society. And you have to weed that out. You have to sort this out in any patient before you could realize and get down to their physical maladies, because a lot of times they're not going to be reliable. And a simple example is, here's a simple example. The one thing that we could do is, like a healthcare provider, to stop and to prevent cancer and strokes and heart disease is to stop smoking. But the thing is, patients don't stop smoking, and that's predominantly a psychosocial or psychological issue. Mm-hmm. You could tell the patient to quit smoking. 99.9% of the time, they're not going to stop smoking. But people have addictions to everything from coffee to the internet.
Okay, Jacob, let's allow time for a response here. So let's bring Alan in here.
Yeah, so this is a great point. I mean, the studies that we do using our unannounced standardized patients, obviously they're able to make the small talk, right? We know what the cases they're presenting with. But we also have looked at hundreds of actual patients presenting to their doctors wearing concealed audio recorders, mostly in the context of the VA health system. And there, I think it is really important to look at what the patient's saying and, you know, the relationship that the doctor is building with the patient. These patients are not always presenting when we study them for the first time. So the doctor's had some opportunities to know about this patient and the way that they present. There are certainly patients who are more difficult in the way they present. I don't care for the phrase reliable narrator myself, and maybe Saul wants to comment on that. But there's an anecdote at the end of our book about a particular patient, Mr. Mason, where a lot of what the physician's job was really about figuring out what's going on in this patient's life.
Okay.
And who can trust who.
All right. Other side of a break, we'll talk more about listening to what matters. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guests today are the co-authors of Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. Saul Wiener's an MD. Alan Schwartz is a cognitive psychologist. They both work at the University of Illinois Chicago, are both teachers there. And they're talking about context in healthcare, not just the symptoms that you present, but also some of the life circumstances that might interfere with your health or your health care. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this issue at 800-838-3760. Maybe you have some stories to share about the details of your life that a doctor missed in a discussion, or maybe something that somebody caught that made your treatment that much better. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. Alan, I kind of put that on you, Saul, before the break about your feelings about the term reliable narrator when it comes to patients.
Yeah, I think that, and just going back to the last caller, I think from what I've seen both as a physician myself and also doing this work, is that far too often we are judgmental of patients and assume that they're not sane when they either are sane or when, even if they have mental health problems, they still have much to say about their lives that is perfectly sane. I would say that we tend to err on, unfortunately, in healthcare, we tend to be judgmental and think that our patients don't know what they're talking about when, in fact, a lot of what they're saying is critical to understand. And so I always are on the side of saying that my patients are, in fact, sane until proven otherwise, and that even if they have mental health problems, I still have to recognize that there's so much that they're trying to tell me that is going to be critical to the care plan.
We've talked about the trend in emphasizing empathy for healthcare providers, but it's been 4 years now plus since we talked to Ronald Schlieffer and Jerry Van Atta. I don't know if you're familiar with their work, but all about narrative in healthcare and how it really is important for doctors to think in terms of stories. So it seems like this aspect of making sure that you got a clear history of people, medical history, plus a little bit of life history as well, has been talked about for a while. Is it slow to catch on?
Well, I think there are a couple things you've said that are I want to dissect apart. One is this idea of empathy. Empathy, if you look at the dictionary definition, is a feeling. It's feeling thinking what somebody else is feeling, and I think it's important to recognize how limited that is in terms of usefulness to another person. I may feel terribly about you, but unless I'm taking the time to figure out what you really need and then taking the action to help you, no amount of empathy is going to really pay off for you as a patient. As far as narrative goes, I think that just getting a narrative in general about a patient can be very time-consuming and not necessarily targeted to what they need. Our idea of context is really more about what's happening in the moment when you're with a patient and they have a particular problem and something doesn't add up. Are you taking the time to sort it out, to figure out what specifically in their life is unresolved and that may account for why they're struggling? So it's a much more targeted approach, I would say, than just the more broad concept of getting a person's life narrative.
Okay, getting some individual real things, facts about their lives that'll really help you in decision-making.
At that moment.
So you mentioned in the book that that using the USPs, the unannounced standardized patients, actors to represent patients, were the turning point in the research. What did you have without them?
Well, you know, when Alan and I started talking about this about 12 years ago, I had been teaching medical students and residents and had noticed that they were getting better and better at this sort of evidence-based stuff, but that when I would go in and talk to a patient, I would discover that there was something key about their life that hadn't been addressed or identified by the resident and that needed to be taken into account to get the care plan right. And I started to see this as a quality issue. You know, what are we doing in healthcare to measure whether physicians are doing well? But I had no idea how to go about it. And so that's when I went and talked to Alan. Alan and I knew each other, but we hadn't really collaborated before. And so I went to Alan. I was like, gosh, you know, how do we begin to measure this? And that's when Alan sort of started developing this idea of using the fake patient. And so I'll turn it over to Alan to talk a little bit about why we chose that approach.
Sure.
Well, if you want to think about what we have without it, so we can go back and imagine the case of the patient with asthma who's not using his medication because he can't afford it. What would the chart look like for a patient like that if the physician doesn't pick up on the context? The chart says something like, you know, worsening asthma, prescribed increase dosage of the existing inhaler, you know, that should control it, follow up in a month. And that chart looks like a perfectly good treatment plan, because if the patient were able to pay for their medication, and if it really was that the medication was at the wrong dose, that's exactly what you would do. But for that patient, it's the wrong treatment plan. It's in fact a harmful treatment plan, because he's going to continue for another month or 2 months with worsening asthma. So without having that kind of direct observation that we get from the actors, all you have is medical records, and medical records are often wrong.
Really?
Oh, yes. We've seen this because we do correlate the records with what our actors do. The actors come in, we have a recording of the visit, we get the records afterwards. We regularly see things that are in the chart that didn't happen in the visit, and there are things that happen in the visit that don't appear in the chart.
Wow, that's a little surprising, but certainly good that you had the record to compare with. Saul, is it a little disappointing to you that only about a third of the doctors wanted to get some feedback out of this study?
Well, in all fairness to them, you know, they are, first of all, they're very busy. These are practicing physicians all over, in our case, the Chicago, Milwaukee area. And we actually were very impressed that they would let us send them fake undercover patients in the first place. I mean, it was a tremendous sort of bit of an act of courage on their part. You know, there's nothing scarier than allowing people to spy on you and not knowing when they're doing it, and know that it's being audio recorded. So we actually were very impressed that the physicians were up for this, and the fact that they didn't necessarily want to know how they did. Well, you know, first of all, we did tell them that we didn't have enough visits for them to draw any broad conclusions about how they as an individual perform. And secondly, you know, in all fairness, these are busy practicing physicians who are just trying to get through the day.
Did you hear some things just verbatims from them along the lines of like, yeah, I heard that red flag. Well, actually, you mentioned this already. You know, some said they were busy and you know, there were other issues going on here. Although, you know, the quote that starts off chapter two is priceless. Doctor, things have been tough since I lost my job. Response is, I'm sorry to hear that. Do you have any allergies?
Yeah, and I think one of the things that Alan and I noticed is that when comments like that were made, it was often because the doctor was preoccupied with the computer, because right now there's this elephant in the room, which is the computer, and the physician is like feeding this computer information throughout the entire visit, and they have to get all that stuff in there in order to bill and in order to get essentially, you know, credit for having done the visit appropriately. And so what often happens is the doctor's sitting there, it's almost like it's a doctor-computer relationship. The doctor's sitting there facing the computer, and the patient is sort of to their side. And the patient is almost like a data repository. I mean, the doctor is, you know, plugging away, going through screen after screen, checking boxes, writing in things, and just asking questions. And so a patient may say something fairly dramatic, like, boy, it's been tough since I've lost my job. And, you know, the doctor's just like, you know, uh-huh, and any allergies? You know, because they're not focused. They're focused on the computer. And I think that's, unfortunately, one of the things we're seeing a lot in this modern era of sort of the digital visit.
All right, I want to talk about remedies to the computer thing, but I do want to get to one other aspect that we haven't talked about with the USPs, the unannounced standardized patients, or the actors. There was a racial component you put in here as well. Could you explain that?
Yeah, well, we had a, for each case, we decided to have a black actor and a white actor basically dress the same way, saying exactly the same thing, follow the same script, just to see if there was a difference in how they were treated in terms of attention to context. All things being equal, and interestingly, we didn't find a statistically significant difference between how black actors and white actors playing the same role were handled in terms of this area of attention to context. Now, anecdotally, our actors often told us, particularly the black actors, that they were more likely to have trouble at the front desk if they said they were uninsured or things like that. That wasn't something we were studying, so that we certainly got cued off that there are issues there in terms of how race might impact care very broadly. But when it came specifically to the likelihood that the doctor would, you know, pick up on context or probe it, they didn't do particularly well with either group.
Hmm. Let's take a call here from Connie and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Dr. Saul Wiener and Dr. Alan Schwartz.
Good morning. I really appreciate the research and time you put into this. Two aspects as a consumer I would like to bring in is the concept of bullying. And this would go across the full range of medical providers, from PAs, nurse practitioners, naturopaths, all the way up to surgeons, saying, you must do this. Your diagnosis is X and you must do Y. And there is no variable. And on the other side of that, locking into whatever they have decided, you know, symptoms ABC is, without the technical backup for their decision. So it's sort of two sides of the same thing, and I've seen this across the board, and I don't know whether it's physicians not, I know physicians sometimes, I know other care providers have a tendency to not want to admit that they don't know, but there seems to be a tremendous fear of not knowing or admitting to the patient that they are unsure, or maybe this is not their area of expertise. Thank you.
All right, thanks for that, Connie. Appreciate it. Whoops.
I think those are two great points, and I'm glad that she made them. One has to do with this fear of acknowledging that you don't know something. I think physicians are often perceived as all-knowing and feel that that's something that they have to kind of maintain, and I think the other comment, she used the term bullying. Bullying is obviously a strong word, but I think I get her point, which is we hear that a lot. We hear a kind of paternalistic approach where doctors are telling patients what they need to do, and that's obviously problematic because, you know, I always remind myself, I work for the patient doesn't work for me, and so, you know, my job is to have a conversation with the patient sort of on a level playing field where I can share with them what I've learned about their healthcare situation, and they have to share with me what they think is going on in their life, and then together we try to work out the best plan. And I think when physicians take a paternalistic approach and it's sort of one-sided, that's a big red flag that they're not thinking about context, that they're not they think the data that's necessary to make a care plan is entirely coming from their end, and that they don't need information about the patient's life. So I'm glad the caller pointed that out.
In some ways, it seems like there's almost more that can go wrong in a patient-doctor conversation than right, because there are so many things that the doctor may not ask about or acknowledge when a patient brings it up, and so many things the patient may not bring up because they don't think it's relevant in the first place. So, well, yeah, this is a little thing on my ear, but I didn't think it was connected to my left elbow. And, you know, extreme example here, but you get the idea that there are bits of context that patients may leave out by their own choice.
Yeah, and I think one of the things we talk about in our book, we have one chapter where we encourage people to think about the doctor-patient relationship. As any kind of relationship, if you were having lunch with a friend and your friend, and I think I mentioned this earlier, brought up a set of challenges they're facing, and then during the conversation they started interacting with you in a way that seemed odd, they seemed angry or withdrawn, you know, I would hope that you would open up your lens and you'd say, gosh, you know, John, what's going on? You seem to be sad or upset. Is there something that's bothering you? In other words, you'd have a wide-angle lens. You'd basically be trying to figure out what the heck's going on. And I think that during a physician-patient encounter, there's something about the way we're training doctors that makes them think that they have to act in this more narrowly focused way. And I think some of that, and perhaps patients also feel like they're in a script, and they have to only answer questions and not, you know, volunteer information. And so you end up with this interaction which is overly narrow, and then the risk, of course, is that the care plan is not going to work.
So what are some of the recommendations that come out of this issue?
Well, I think that, as Alan pointed out a few minutes ago, patients, first of all, should be alert to the problem. Before I went to medical school, I kind of thought doctors were all-knowing and all you had to do was walk in there and answer questions. But in fact, if you're aware as a patient that your physician may have a sort of biomedical focus, that they may be overly narrow in the kind of questions they ask about and the way they think about you, then you may be more likely to speak up and volunteer and say, you know, doc, there are some things about my situation that I'd like to share with you. I'm really not able to take this medicine every day, or I can't afford it, or I'm wondering if there's anything that you can do to help me with this. I think if patients are aware of these limitations that are not universal but are common, they may be more willing to kind of step out there. And also just to be aware that this is about them. It's not about the doctor or the visit. You know, when you go to the doctor, it's important to recognize that the goal for both parties is that you walk out there with, satisfied that the plan is right.
There's really some fascinating stuff in here, and I really appreciate both of you giving us your time today. Saul Wiener is an MD. Alan Schwartz is a cognitive psychologist. They both work at the University of Illinois Chicago, and they are the co-authors of Listening for What Matters, Avoiding Contextual Errors in Healthcare. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you.